and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're talking about falling oil prices and what Alaska and other Arctic countries can learn from Norway. The Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, hosted Ambassador Cora Oss. This luncheon was recorded at the Dena'ina Center on Monday, May 16th of 2016. AWAC President Lisa Falsko is our moderator, and we'll join her now.
By the Alaska World Affairs Council. We're going to go ahead and get started on time. We've got a big packed schedule of some great speakers and presentations, so we're going to just go ahead and start. People can continue coming in if you're out there getting your lunch. I'd like to just take a second to thank the Chamber of Commerce and the exceptional staff of the Alaska World Affairs Council, Alyssa, Menica, Kari, Bruce Bustamante, Corey Hester. You know, it's such a great thing for the World Affairs Council to be partnering with the Chamber of Commerce. And these folks make programs like today possible, and we're just so thrilled to be here today. So big round of applause to the Chamber of Commerce. And given the international topic today, I'd like to now introduce our first guest speaker. He's going to briefly talk about foreign investment in the U.S. economy. David Anderson, if you could come to the podium. He is the co-founder and president of Whatcom Opportunities Regional Center, Inc. Mr. Anderson has been involved with EB-5 U.S. Immigrant Investor Program for over a decade. Currently, he's a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association Investor, EB-5, Committee, and president of the Association to Invest in the USA to USA, the industry association for active EB-5 regional centers in the United States. David Anderson is also a practicing attorney in the state of Washington, specializing in U.S. immigration law, particularly immigration through business and investment. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me in welcoming David Anderson.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I have a confession to make. Both my friend Bob and I have confessions to make. This is the first time in all of our lives, his longer than mine, that we've been to Alaska. And I got to tell you that we are very impressed. The sunshine is amazing. Coming from Washington State, I imagine it must be like this all the time. Ethan Tyler from the Department of Commerce kindly suggested that we make the trip, and I'm very glad that he did. He guided us down to Seward, if I pronounce that right. We saw some whales, lots of them, and we got to see wildlife on the way back, and we got to stop at the ski hill. So we've seen some pretty beautiful parts of Alaska. I'm sure there's lots more to see. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to talk about a federal government program, which is kind of unique. If you follow the news, it gets some press nowadays, but it's probably the neatest little government program that you've never heard of. It attracts foreign direct investment into the United States at no cost to the U.S. taxpayer. I know that you fiscally conservative Alaskans would appreciate that proposition. It's not often that you can get a federal government program that to date in fiscal year 2015 brought in $4.3 billion, that's B with a B, dollars into the U.S. economy. But Ethan told me that you don't have an EB-5 program in Alaska, .. yet. So one of the reasons Bob and I have come to Alaska is to participate in this Northern EB-5 forum. And Ethan has some extra brochures. It starts at 1:30 across the street at the Atwood building. And we'll be at it for about 4.5 hours. So by the time, if you come and join us, you walk away from that session, if you don't know a little bit of something about EB-5, Bob and I will have not done a very good job. But for those of you that can't make it, let me just give you a 60,000-foot, very brief overview. The bargain is, EB-5 is an immigration term. It stands for the Employment-Based Fifth Preference. It is a job creation program. The bargain is if a foreigner invests $1 million in the United States and creates at least 10 full-time jobs, then that investor and his family can have green cards, and they can move to the United States and become U.S. citizens. That's the bargain. The bargain is sweetened when an investor invests in a rural area or a targeted employment area which has high unemployment. For only $500,000, an investor can move to America. 95% of the program operates at the $500,000 level, but there are moves afoot to increase the amount. It's an incredibly flexible program. Investment goes into many different areas, from real estate investment. There has been investment in mining and oil. The regional center that I operate out of Bellingham, Washington, I can see the Alaska Ferry from my kitchen window, comes in every Friday. We operate in the transportation finance business to put environmentally compliant trucks on the road. So if anybody here is looking for a new truck, come and see me. So that's the scope of the program. It's flexible, and this afternoon we're meeting with economic development officers from around the state, and we're going to see if it isn't something that you might be able to use in this beautiful state of yours. And so, in conclusion, I'm so pleased that I finally made it to Alaska and to beautiful Anchorage. I'd like to thank Bruce Bustamante for giving me the opportunity to say hi to you all, and especially to Ethan Tyler, who enticed me up here and has been taking very good care of us. And nice to meet you, and hope to see you if you come over to the forum across the street.
And I'd like to recognize our illustrious Mayor Ethan Berkowitz. If you wouldn't mind standing, we're so pleased that you joined us here today. And then at this time, I'd like to bring the ambassador up to the podium, if you'd like to sit on the far right here. And while he's coming up, I'd want to give a little plug for Sons of Norway. I see a lot of Sons of Norway members here. And we found out yesterday that the U.S. Census has now said that 28,000 Alaskans claim Norwegian heritage. So if you are one of those 28,000 people, raise your hand. Do you have any Norwegian heritage?
Wow, wow.
Look at that. Okay, so our ambassador is going to be participating in the Sons of Norway event tomorrow. For all of you that raise your hand and those who are curious about those people who raise their hand, they'll be at the park strip on the west side at 6 o'clock tomorrow for the big 17th of May celebration. So come down and check that out. Okay, I just want to say what an honor and a privilege it is to be here on the stage with you, Ambassador Kåre Aas. This is really a highlight for me and for all of you folks who have come today. You all probably all know of his bio. It was on the website and posted in the different places that we've been advertising. I just want to make a couple of highlights on there. He is the current Norwegian ambassador to the U.S., and he presented his credentials for President Obama in 2013. And before that, he was the ambassador to Afghanistan. I don't know which one is a little bit scarier, D.C. or Afghanistan, but he might be able to tell us that. And he was also the political director in the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And in my opinion, he's the best U.S. ambassador from Norway that we have seen. You know, he's smart. He's extremely knowledgeable. He didn't pay me to say any of this. He's open. He's approachable. He's really endeared himself to our community. The Sons of Norway gave him an award yesterday for all of his work that he's done. I'm bringing the King of Norway here, and he's been here now, is this your fifth time? And he's the first ambassador to be marching with the Norwegian community tomorrow in the parade. So we are just thrilled and happy to have you, so thank you so very, very much for coming. The format that we're going to have today is he's going to talk for about 10 minutes. He has a slide presentation to give everyone a background on our topic today. And then we'll have a discussion on that topic, some follow-up questions. And then we'll open up to the audience for all of you. Based on my experience, Alaskans are knowledgeable about this topic and very interested. So we want to hear from you, what you are thinking and what's on your mind. And he is open to take questions directly from you. So there will be microphones on the two sides of the room. So we'll have two microphones going. And with that, let me get you the clicker.
Thank you, Lisa, and Mayor. Good to see you, and also that there are so many, many familiar faces in the room. It's great to be back in Anchorage, and I will stay here throughout the week. And on Wednesday, I will be going down to Petersburg to celebrate also with the Norwegian Americans there. And before I came here, I was asked whether I could comment on that question. And to me, I think it's difficult to give recommendations to you. But what I can do is really to give a Norwegian perspective on the falling oil prices and how Norway has been shaping its energy sector since the end of the 1960s. And in helping me, I have some slides which I hope will work. Is it this one? Mm-hmm. Okay, this will take time. there we have it. That was the first one. So what I will start by saying, and since I have 10 minutes, I will do some sort of general points, is that Norway, we produce almost 2 million barrels a day from the Norwegian continental shelf. And it's all our activity is offshore. And the Norwegian gas cover more than 20% of the natural gas consumption in Europe. So Norway is the second biggest gas exporter to the world's third largest gas exporter, so, as you see on that slide. So the petroleum activities have been crucial for Norway's economic growth since it started in the end of the 1960s, as I said. And it's important, of course, for economic growth and for financing the welfare state. And today, the oil and gas industry is Norway's most important industry. Last year, oil and gas accounted for about 40% of our exports and 15% of Norway's GDP. And also a quarter of all investments in Norway is the oil and gas sector. Also an important part of our energy sector is, of course, also the supply industry and the service industry, which is also the second largest export from Norway after oil and gas. I have been, as Lisa said, I have been to Alaska now. This is my fifth visit to Alaska, and I've always been asked of the Norwegian sovereign wealth fund. And today, it amounts to approximately $800 billion U.S. dollars, and it was established in 1996. The years prior to that, the oil and gas revenues, they were used to invest in the oil and gas sector itself. But since 1996, it has now, as I said, it's now amounting to $800 billion U.S. dollars. Then I think what is important also with the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund is that we have a national consensus in Norway, and that was decided by the parliament some years back, that the fund can be spent by the Norwegian state according to what we called the so-called 4% rule. And the rule says, and that rule is from a decision by the parliament, the rule says that then in average, we can spend 4% annually of the market value of the fund into the Norwegian economy and into the state budgets. So far, the government has not spent 4%. I think last year it was the highest, and that was 2.5% of the value of the fund. So my government, the government, is very, I would say, cautious and not allocating too much money from the fund into the economy in order not to heaten up the economy. But these days, with the implication of the falling oil prices, we see that we have a higher unemployment within the oil and gas sector or energy sector than we have in other sectors, which also means that we have to the government has to stimulate the economy in order to bring these people back into the labor force, and that is being done particularly targeting the southwest coast of Norway, but also some other parts of the Norway. But it's very sort of regional, and Norway, the northern parts of Norway, I would say the economy there is booming due to other economic activities. And I also think that you heard I said that the amount of the oil and gas sector for our GDP and our total revenues. I think what is also important in order for you to sort of understand Norway and our economy is that we have a very, I would say, a very diversified economy. It's not based on just the energy sector, but indeed also on other sectors. So as I said, we have some sort of, we see some consequences of the falling oil prices, but I think that it's not people are concerned, but I would say that we also, all Norwegians and the political parties, that we understand that there is an end to the oil and gas sector, the energy sector. We have to go into renewables more than we do on oil and gas. But still we see that the gas will be a fundamental part of our revenues, and that there still will be need for gas export to Europe. We have also, when Norway became an oil and gas exporter, it started in the southern parts of Norway, and you see the United Kingdom, the Great Britain there down to the left. We have been moving gradually towards the north, and when we settled the delimitation talks with Russia in 2011, that really sort of made it very predictable what is the Russian part of the Barents Sea and what is the Norwegian part of the Norwegian Sea, Barents Sea. And that delimitation agreement, we got it after having negotiated first with Soviet Union and with Russia for more than 40 years. But now it's predictable. So we are moving gradually towards the north. And I also would like to say that I think that Norway has been good in sort of balancing the need for extraction of these oil and gas resources, but at the same time maintaining and sustaining the development. And there is an annual white paper to the parliament which is discussing and recommending to the parliament what should be the sort of where to move next and where not to do oil and gas activities. So this yellow part of the map that has been sort of restricted or limited for oil and gas activities because there are so wealthy fish stocks around that same area, and it's also an important part of Norwegian tourism. But I think that the sort of annual paper to the white paper to the parliament is really a political instrument. Which is also have taken into account the various sectorial interests in everything related to over the coast and not necessarily just the energy sector. So we also, I mean, the government is also saying and telling its citizens and also the international community that in challenging times like we have today with these falling oil prices, it's especially important also to keep a long-term perspective in mind and not to be too scared. But it's also, and we see that there is still a huge potential for the oil and gas activities on the Norwegian continental shelf for many, many, many years. And the state of Alaska and Norway, we have also one thing in common, that we are part of the Arctic. In the case of Norway, 10% of the Norwegian population lives north of the Arctic Circle, and 80% of our waters is also north of that circle, while one-third of the land territory of Norway is also north of the polar circle. So I think that the regulations which we also have now and the way the United States is carrying out its chair of the Arctic Council is a good way forward. So I would also like just also to repeat that that Norway, that we base our oil and gas activities on the highest health, safety, and environmental standards, and combine, and that we are combining the role of a frontrunner in climate change policies and being a large exporter of oil and gas. Let me also mention before I conclude that last Friday, President Obama, he had a summit with the Nordic leaders. And an important part of that meeting was devoted to climate change, and it was devoted to the Arctic. And I think that what was the main message, not main message, but one of the main messages from my prime minister, and she underlined that climate change is important. Norway is a strong advocate for the Paris Agreement. We are one of the first to ratify the Paris Agreement. And but at the same time, it's not just about climate, it's also about sustainable economic development. And that was an important message, and I also think that message is really what it's all about when considering what Norway has been doing within the energy sector for 40, 50 years, and which will continue to be that policy, that we are balancing the need for oil and gas resources but at the same time also sustaining the environment. So with those words, I think I will be open for questions and comments.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, so I saw that one of your slides, you talked about how much oil and gas represents your revenues. And you also talked about falling oil prices, which we are all very familiar with what that means. But for us, 90% of our state revenues are based on oil and gas. And it looked like from one of your slides, only 20% of yours. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. Has that always been the case, that it's been about 20%? And what constitutes the other 80%?
Yeah. It has been a bit higher. It was into the 30-35%. But I think, as I said also, that that we have a diversified economy, and the maritime sector is very, very important to Norway. The same is the fisheries, fish farming. I shouldn't perhaps say that here, but fish farming is important to
my
country.
We'll talk about that.
And IT, tourism. And what we are witnessing and what we are seeing and experiencing is also the tourism sector. People want to go to the northern parts of or to the Arctic, and also generating resources. So IT is another one. So I mean, the 20% is one-fifth, so which means that all these other sectors are equally or more important altogether than the oil and gas sector. Let me also make one point which I would like to highlight also, is that when I'm in Washington, I'm always D.C., I'm always been questioned about gender issues and women's rights and women's participation in the labor force. And statistically, we have seen that in Norway, and we have been good on gender for many, many, many years, and I think that 70% or more of the women are in our labor force. And the impact of women in our economy is bigger than the whole oil and gas sector has been ever. So that also shows that fighting for gender and women into the labor force is really also good for the economy, but also for many, many other reasons, of course.
Okay, so if there's any news folks out here, there's a sound bite for you for the newspaper for
and
tomorrow.
And I'm not participating in your domestic political situation and the presidential campaign, but I'm just noting what's happening in Norway.
Maybe you can expand on those sectors. So you mentioned maritime and IT and tourism and growth potential. What does that growth potential look like when you're envisioning that coming up in the next few years and we're looking at other growth potentials? What does it look like for Norway in those sectors?
So can you specify that? What do you mean by
that? So what is it, what are you doing to promote the growth of tourism and how is it changing to be growing and IT and maritime and...
Yeah, I think that, for example, the maritime sector has that's since the Norway's independence and before that, the maritime sector has been and so important. And it's always, back in the 1980s, it accounted for 10% of GDP, and I'm sure that's still the case. But I think that what we are doing, we are promoting the government, promoting this sector. But it's also, of course, up for the private enterprises themselves to seek for opportunities and possibilities. Perhaps except for the tourism sector, where I see there is a very strong, I would say, relationship or link between the private sector and municipalities and the region, in order to stimulate people to visit Norway. And we see now a huge amount of tourism in at Svalbard, this archipelago close to the North Pole.
Okay, and the Arctic Committee, they have a slogan called One Arctic. So, do you see this type of growth also in the other Arctic countries? You see those same areas for Iceland and Finland and Sweden and Russia, Canada.
It's not for me to comment on other countries. And I think if we look to Iceland, I mean. Like the oil and gas sector in Norway is so important, that is the same for fisheries in Iceland. But I think there is huge potential for the Arctic region, as long as it's in being maintained. It's being maintained as a stable region. And I think that what we now are witnessing within the Arctic Council, there is more sort of emphasis on the Arctic. We are working closer together, all eight countries, and I think that's the way to move forward. And we know that I think it's 25% or more of all the sort of undiscovered gas and oil resources. They are still in the Arctic, and I think that there are huge potential for tourism, fisheries, maritime transport. I mean, with the ice melting, that's of course a challenge, but it also provides an opportunity. And when you know that you can be sailing from Rotterdam to Japan. Using, I think it's 11 days or something, 20%. You cut the transport with 20% over 11 days in an area which is stable compared to going through the Suez Canal into the Indian Ocean. I think that annually there are 20,000 vessels vessels going through the Suez Canal. Still, there are less than 100 ships going along the Norwegian coast and the Northeast Passage. But I mean that could be changed indeed.
Okay. Well, then let's take it a little bit back home then. So fishing is very important here in Alaska. And so let's talk about fish farming and from the environment. Why not? From the environmental standpoint. And you talk about how important the environment is and going green for Norway. And what does that mean for fish farming as compared to, for example, the environmental impact from cattle or chickens or something like that?
We have... And I've seen in the room there are some dedicated supporters of wild fish and wild salmon. So I'm not sure whether I should talk about the fish farming. But let me tell you that when fish farming started in Norway, fish farming in the beginning of the 1970s, that was 0%, 0 kilos. Today, it's 1.3 million tons we are exporting, of particular Atlantic salmon, to 150 countries with a value of approximately $10 billion. And the market is growing and the opportunities, they are huge. Also my understanding is that it's less damaging to the environment than other sort of production of, and you refer to beef and chicken. I would also say that this is an industry in Norway or a sector in Norway with a lot of people are proud and people are feeling good about what they are doing. And I think that my and our expectations is that this will continue to grow and that we also see, I mean, we also think that we have high environmental standards related to fish farming. There has been a lot of discussion about antibiotics, and I think that that compared to, you said, these two other, the chicken and beef, that there are less sort of antibiotics being used in fish farming in Norway than on these other products. This is happening. This is happening in the same parts of along the coast, like where we have also oil and gas industry. And so far, it's primarily Atlantic salmon, but we are also sort of looking into whether this also there could be opportunities also for other sort of fish.
Yeah, okay. Fish species.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed that Costco, not in Alaska, of course, but outside of Alaska, is selling Norwegian farmed salmon and calling it raised without antibiotics. So I'm curious what that means and how Norway's been able to address those concerns for that.
So far, I would say that, and before I came here, as Lisa said, I think she said it, I was the political director in Norway. And the only country where we have had huge problems on these antibiotics, that's with China. And that had nothing to do with antibiotics. It had to do with that the Chinese dissident was given the Peace Prize in 2010. And since then, they sort of they targeted over salmon. But they are so sneaky, so they import all their salmon now from Vietnam, but it's still from Norway and from Cambodia. So, but I think that what we have seen also, what I read the other day, is that since this salmon is labeled as it is, that there is a huge increase also in the sort of the consumption of Norwegian salmon here in the United States.
Well, our paper talked today about exporting crafted beer, so you know maybe we need to talk about some other options as well. But so I know you're not a specialist in every country, but have you seen what some other Nordic countries are doing that might be interesting for Norway to consider, or maybe Alaskans to consider as far as economic growth potential?
No, that's a difficult one. I think that some of them are very good on design, furniture, but also to a certain extent also Norway. But they are different. The countries are different, even Norway and Sweden and Denmark, partly because Norway is so huge on oil and gas. So. I think also, if you allow, I just say two words on the migration crisis. Is that okay?
Of course.
Because this could change very much, I think the situation in Europe. As you know, there was this huge, this hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees entering Europe last fall, there is now a huge fear, I would say, that including in the United States, that what we saw last fall could sort of be worse this summer. For what has happened is that the sort of people fleeing their countries, being refugees or fleeing for other reasons, and I think it's totally legitimate for people to leave due to also economic and economic reasons, but I mean we have this sort of asylum institute by the United Nations, and we have to sort of do this in accordance with the international rules and regulations, and we are doing that. But my point is that last fall, I think there was specifically Germany, Austria, and the Nordic countries who sort of reached out to and had a sort of solidaric approach to the people coming. But this year, it could be worse. We have stopped now the sort of the transfer of people, and it's organized crime behind this. But they were passing, they were coming from the Middle East, they were coming from Afghanistan and other countries to Norway and the other countries which I mentioned. We think now that there are at least 1 million people in Libya from various nations in Africa who want to cross the Mediterranean and to go to Europe. I'm telling you this because this could have and will have a huge impact on these nations, not just budget, but also political situations. And we see that there is an increase in populism, there is an increase in nationalism, there is an increase on parties to the right, the parties to the left, and I also think it could be damaging for the relationship between Europe and the United States in the long run. And it has an impact on our budgets, for sure. Just to mention, in Norway last year, we had to reallocate 20% of our development budget, and we are one of the few spending 1% of our GDP on development aid. But 20% of that budget was reallocated to meet the needs of those who came to Norway. And we all thought that they were Syrians. In the case of Norway, there were 34 countries, people from 34 countries crossing through Russia on the Russian border up there in the north, coming over that border. And the two last persons who came, they came from Cuba. And they are all seeking political refuge. But I mean, the reason is that they are coming for other reasons. So I'm just mentioning this because I think that if you see the same happening this summer and this fall, I think that will have huge consequences for the sort of the whole how we sort of have been seeing and how we have been working and cooperating with Europe since the end of the Second World War.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans, and you are hearing a discussion with Norwegian Ambassador Cora Aas. The topic is falling oil prices and what Alaskans can learn from Norway. We return to Alaska World Affairs Council's Lisa Falsko as she leads the conversation.
Okay, so on that, so do you have a process for integration and workforce development of this million plus people that are coming into your country?
Yeah, in the case of Norway, we try that. Sweden, exactly the same. But we also have to sort of, since we have to implement international norms and regulations, those not fulfilling the sort of the requirements for being refugees, they have to be sent back to the country of origin or the country where they first came. And that is also why the European Union and Turkey negotiated a sort of a political agreement on how to handle this in the future. And we have to see whether that will function. We hope it will function. But let me also say that for Sweden, Norway's neighbor, Sweden's populations rose with 2% last year due to the number of refugees and migrants coming to Sweden. That's huge.
Yeah, that is huge. Okay, so let's go to, like you said, one of Alaskans' favorite topics, the permanent fund, oil wealth fund. And Alaskans, we look north and see, or I guess we don't actually look north, we kind of look sideways, and see your 800 plus billion wealth fund and largest in the world created in the late 90s compared to ours, 50 billion created two decades before yours. And so we want to know, what is Norway's strategy and what is your vision when it comes to oil wealth? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think it is the reason why we established the fund and the reason why it's being sort of having the shape as it has. I think it's very much sort of based on the fundamental values, I would say, of Norway and the Norwegian society and the political system, which is very, at least it was, people care for each other, the solidarity among different social strata is very strong, and the whole idea that that we are not going to use these revenues today, but we are really going to have those revenues for the future. And I must say, it struck me that there is no one challenging this 4% rule. There is no one trying to indicate that we should spend more money from the fund, even though they could be unemployed. But the sort of the basic idea that this is for the next generation and the generations after that is so solid, and it's so sort of part of, I would say, the Norwegian society. That is the sort of the political consensus and stability around that fund is I would say incredible, and it's also being administered by an independent organization, which is reporting to the government or the Minister of Finance once a year, and the Minister of Finance or the government presents a white paper to the Parliament every year. But no one, as I said, no one is questioning the sort of the fundamental principles of the fund, and I'm sure it will be like that forever.
So who set up those fundamental principles, the 4% spend rule and that? who was that?
That was the Parliament, being also sort of based on the recommendations from the government. So we have 7 or 8 political parties now in the Parliament, and they sort of go from the left to the to the right, this sort of the whole notion or the whole idea or the sort of the consensus around the fund is I think it's one of the sort of the important aspects of the fund, but it's also one of the important values of the fund.
So is it the Parliament then that created the vision and is the steward and keeps the vision going? Is that the Parliament that decides that, or do people ever vote? Or
No, that's the Parliament. I mean, we have a parliamentarian system, as you know, and they are being elected based on their party programs, so that's how we do it. And I think this sort of, as I said, this sort of solidarity concept of solidarity is still very, very strong in my country.
Okay, and I noticed, you know, there's a lot of power in names that we give to things, and I noticed that Norway changed the name of its sovereign wealth fund in 2006. It was called the Petroleum Fund. And is now called the Government Pension Fund Global. Why was that change made?
It was a name change, but it was the first name was too much related to the sort of the pension fund which we have for sort of paying pensions to people when they retire, and we wanted to change it to make it more understandable. So one last comment on the fund is really that there are many countries reaching out to Norway in order to sort of learning from the fund, and we see that from exporting oil and gas exporting nations in Africa, in the Middle East, the Gulf, who really wants to see whether they can set up something similar, so we are doing that. We are advising and we are giving our recommendations, and we have also now established what we call Oil for Development, which is like countries which have resources but have not yet started to extract them. And one of those countries is Afghanistan, where I served, as you said. And we started to have a dialogue with the Afghans also to help them draft their petroleum laws and in order for one day that country to be stable and to make use of those resources.
Fascinating. Okay, so I'll ask one more question before we open up to the audience. If I can see who's holding the microphones, that'll help direct those. So talking about recommendations and the pension fund. So our legislatures are in the process of finishing up their 90-day extension in the legislature, and we have a $4 billion gap that we're trying to figure out how to meet. The options on the table are raising taxes, taking money from the permanent fund, changing tax structures for the oil companies. Do you have any thoughts on that or recommendations on?
I don't.
I'm sure people in the audience do. So that was a nice segue into that. Where's the microphones? Okay, super. So this is your opportunity to ask the ambassador directly whatever question you want unfiltered. If we could start here with in the front, bring the microphone. I think that this might be easier to go back and forth to the folks.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Paul Dunscombe. I'm with the World Affairs Council, and wanted to thank you very much for that very interesting talk. I'm kind of bouncing back and forth between two questions, both of which I think are somewhat difficult to answer, and one of them has to do with just Norway being able to demonstrate that the time to be a good steward of your wealth is while you still actually have it, and how you were able to manage that. But I thought on a slightly different topic, one other thing that's liable to roil European politics over the course of the summer is the whole question of Brexit and Britain's potential vote to leave the EU. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the potential impacts of that and what you think the likelihood of that might be.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. So it was Brexit, not the first one. You know that Norway, we are not a member of the European Union, so we are perfectly happy not being that. And but we are part of the internal market. And we are also, since we have the sort of association agreement with the European Union, we are also implementing all the sort of acquis decisions in Brussels in our national legislations. And I think that Norway is on top three among the European countries implementing the acquis effectively. So we are also good on that, even though we are not a member of the European Union. And we don't have, as you understand, we are not part of the political decision-making processes of the European Union. We have said, my government has said, that we want Britain to remain in Europe. Personally, I think that it's important also for the transatlantic relationship between the United States and Europe that you have the sort of the Britain's voice in EU discussions. And I think that that will change dramatically if they leave. And I also think that will have consequences for. Even though they had the Scottish, they had the referendum some very short time ago, and I think that that could be reopened if they leave the European Union. So all in all, I think that are from a Norwegian perspective, there's just sort of downsides by Britain leaving the European Union, and it also, I think, it has also to do with what we are seeing now, sort of, and I refer to it very briefly on the sort of nationalistic and populistic trends in Europe, and we see that in France. We saw that the other day of the presidential elections in Austria, and also some of the Nordic countries. It's also, I would say, it's a challenging development with some of these political forces, and I think it has to do with fear. It has to do with racism, I think, and a lack also of a good integration policy. And that is also why I think that Lisa asked about what we are doing with all these people coming. I think that's a fundamental part of the solution, is really to integrate them in the best manner possible into the various societies.
Okay. And this side?
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. Eric Pickett with the World Affairs Council. And thank you again for coming. So we saw some slides earlier where you were, we saw the linearly, right, how great the fund has grown, but then also where you were just showing just general revenues that have been received from the Norwegian government, from the oil and gas companies. How much credit would you give over the last several decades having a fiscal tax policy and the Norwegian people not, or the government not reaching back out and renegotiating, allowing the oil and gas companies to understand where their own revenues may be 30, 40 years down the road? How much is that attributed to this slide and the next slide?
I think that I think that Norway and has always been predictable for the companies. I think that Norway has been very predictable towards the companies on sort of what you asked about the taxation. And I've been told that when all this history started, that some of these companies, they were very sort of critical to the how much tax they had to pay. And then the answer from the Norwegian government was, that's fine with us, we find another company. And then they said, okay, we stay. And so they remained. And I think that is sort of predictability, and that they are still able to earn a lot of money. Is still, of course, also important to the companies. And I should have mentioned that when we have seen this, when we have had these falling oil prices, what we at the same time have seen is that the Norwegian krone, our currency, has been weakened compared to euro and US dollars. So in a way, it has been sort of compensated a bit. But of course, not the sort of 60-70% drop in oil prices as we have had. But I hope that answered your question.
And the weakening of the krona, that's because it's the barrels of oil is based on dollars.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay.
Yes, I believe Norway still, even though you're so rich with an $800 billion fund, that you still have income tax. Is that true? And is it controversial that Norwegians pay income tax even though they have this huge sovereign wealth fund? Thank you.
We have income tax and we have sales tax of 25%. We have probably the highest oil price and the gasoline prices in the world. For a liter, we pay close to $2, I think, for a liter.
And there's what, 4 liters in a gallon?
Yeah,
or so?
Something like that. So there you have the price of of that, and yeah, we have income tax, and we will always have income tax, and I think that Norwegians or people in the workforce, I would guess that they pay approximately 35% in an average on income tax, but also of course it's progressive, so it depends also how much you. Much you earn. So, but an average 35, yeah? Something like that. Yeah.
Well, there's other taxes.
And that is not being questioned. It's not being questioned. There has been a discussion this last year on the company taxes, and which the present government wants to lower, not very much, but to reduce, in order to sort of create new activities because of the situation we have with an increased unemployment. I think that now the unemployment rate in Norway is 4.5%, but it's regionally. There are differences in regional differences. So where we have the oil and gas activities in the sort of the southwest, it's higher than other parts of the country, and that is also why the government wants to stimulate activities in that part of in Norway in order to sort of bring people back to work.
Okay, so you mentioned 35% tax approximately for income. What about your car tax? How does that work?
The car tax is very high.
You have a lot of taxes, don't you?
So I think that the value of the car, I think the sale tax, but I mean, I'm not sure about the percentage, but I think you have to double the price of the car due to taxes. Huh? So, mm-hmm. I mean, if you can buy the car for $30,000, you pay, when you buy it in Norway, $60,000.
So there's a lot of good taxes besides the sales tax or the income tax going on there. Who has the microphone? Okay, perfect.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Johnston. I just got back from Harstad last week, where our daughter and her family are paying $35 a month for heat and electricity for a three-bedroom home. but besides that...
that's right.
My understanding is Norway did an excellent job of exporting the support industry and technology of the oil and gas industry. And did you have that included in your GDP?
Yeah.
So that was because...
That was also part of the export of the supply and the sort of service industries.
And just to follow up, do you still export some of your hydroelectricity?
Yeah, we export most of it. So that's... I mean, we have as you say, we have... The hydropower is huge in Norway and always been due to sort of the natural circumstances, and so that's a huge part of our export too. Thank you for mentioning that.
I think they're very lucky because it's going to be a cold, wet day tomorrow, so they'll like the heat.
Okay, and do we have the microphone over here? Super.
Good afternoon, Norman Rookberg. I'll be meeting my family in Vestfossen near Hokksund and Drummond in a few weeks, but. Given your perspective in Afghanistan, could you comment, number one, on Norway and the United States' obligations to NATO, and more specifically in Afghanistan, and then also overall about the commitment of the United States to the continuing commitment to NATO?
Yeah. No, thank you. Next week, and in 2 days, there will be a NATO ministerial meeting. The foreign ministers, they will be meeting in Brussels. NATO ministerial foreign ministers, they will be meeting in Brussels this week. And then in July, there will be a NATO summit in Warsaw. And I think that what is important with that summit is really that we have to sort of not recommit, but I really think it's important that that message really is about strengthening the relationship between the United States and Europe. And I think that what the United States has been doing these last couple of years after the annexation of Crimea and Russia's interference in Ukraine has really also witnessed the commitment by the United States to Europe, also by sort of strengthening their military presence and military exercises in for example the Baltic countries, and I think that would also be done by some other NATO allies, European like Norway. We will also increase our activities and our cooperation with the Baltic state, as since they are member of NATO. And on Afghanistan, I think that what is needed in Afghanistan is really in order for that country to be stabilized and to have stability, we need to sort of they have to strike a political deal with Taliban and the insurgents, and it's difficult to see that now, but I think that for example, the Colombian government and the insurgents, they have been negotiating for many years. Norway has facilitated that dialogue for a long time, and I think that soon I think that there will be possible to sort of for President Santos in Colombia to declare that they have a political settlement with FARC, the insurgents. So I think that also needed in Afghanistan. What we are seeing now is that Taliban and other insurgents, they are taking more and more control over bigger areas of the country. So I think that the sort of the incentives for a political agreement now is grimmer than they were two, 3 years back. And it's not surprise that Norway have been trying to facilitate a dialogue between the government in Kabul and Taliban for many years, and that was part of the job I had there. What we have said and what we are saying is that for a political deal to be struck in Afghanistan, it's really important that deal has to women has to be part of that deal, have to be part of that deal, civil society have to be part of that deal, and it can't just be a deal between those with weapons and the government. But I think that it's important for the international community to stay committed in Afghanistan, both militarily and on with development aid, and I think that will be one of the results also of the Warsaw Summit meeting in July, and then there will also be a ministerial meeting on Afghanistan in Brussels in October. So I think that we all know that the war has been going on for so many years and with so many sacrifices. But I can't see that there are any sort of solutions to continuing our presence in Afghanistan, and we should learn from what happened in Iraq also in that regard. Thank you.
And with that, I want to thank the Ambassador Kåre Aas so much for coming and talking with us today. And thank you to Bruce Bustamante and his crew at the Chamber of Commerce for making this possible. If you like programs like this, please consider supporting the Chamber of Commerce, becoming a member, and the Alaska World Affairs Council. We are starting up our Ambassador Series for the summer, and we'd love to see you at more of our events. And from everyone at the Chamber of Commerce and the World Affairs Council, have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans. Today, we've heard from Norwegian Ambassador Kåre Aas. The topic was falling oil prices and what Alaskans can learn from Norway. This was recorded on May 16th of 2016 at the Tenaya Center. I'm your host and producer, Eric Bork.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.